Live from New York City, it's The Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, and I'd like to welcome you to this program. Today, the latest on health and healing, what onions have that could help your brain, how to halt those really painful and irritating urinary tract infections, some information from Victoria Dolby Towles from Life Extension. I'm going to talk about something that almost never gets discussed, and that is gold and tea together could help treat prostate cancer. I'll give you the latest on that. If time permits, smart meter dangers, the health hazards of wireless electromagnetic radiation exposure and why you should not allow them in your home. Again, if time permits, from Dr. Joseph Marcola, celebrity doctors and Bill Gates linked to GlaxoSmithKline fraud. That's important because I will be continuing today to share insights into our original in-depth investigative reporting white paper on the GlaxoSmithKline. And by the way, for people who want to read the entire article with all of its footnotes and references, you can read the article entitled Bad to the Bone, Fraud is the Business Plan by myself and Dr. Nancy Ashley. It's a long article, and it's on all of our websites. In addition to that article, another recent article that was just printed last week, we had two back-to-back, is called, it's all about Gardasil and pimping for Big Pharma. So pimping for Big Pharma and bad to the bone. Two brand new original in-depth investigative reports. One's on vaccines. The other is on the pharmaceutical industry and why it's able to get away with, in effect, killing people. My guest today, when he comes in, he's upstairs being filmed. We have already filmed him for one important documentary, and now we're filming him for another I've been working on for 5 years. We're going to finish it up in the next 3 months, Poverty Inc. Professor Joe Buckhahn. Now, many of you know Dr. Buckhahn because he is a professor of constitutional and economic law. He is an internationally recognized legal scholar at the University of British Columbia, a Rhodes Scholar, and law degrees from Oxford University and Harvard University. He is also the author of the best-selling book that turned into the Academy Award documentary, The Corporation, The Pathological Pursuit of Profit and Power. And we're going to talk about a look at corporate pathology and its role in the domination of children's development for profit and power. Monsanto, A Modern-Day Plague by Lisa Cerda. So we have a lot to share, and let us begin. Each year, I counsel a lot of people who have urinary tract infections, principally women. And most people know that UTIs, urinary tract infections, are the most common form of bacterial infection. How many? Well, just to doctors' offices this year, we're expecting 8 million, 7 million last year, and 1 million emergency room visits, and at least 100,000 people minimally were hospitalized, and it cost upwards of $1.5 billion. And one-third of all women will contract urinary tract infections by the age of 24. And once you have had it, your risk of reoccurrence is 20%. So why should we be getting them at all? And then people end up taking Cipro, which is I'm absolutely opposed to, and cephalexin, and trimethylthorapren, and these are antibiotics. They're broad-spectrum antibiotics. And they cause digestive disorders, nausea, fatigue, secondary infections. And eventually what's going to happen in everyone is that you take an antibiotic that may have one time worked, but now it doesn't because the microorganisms have evolved to evade their own destruction. So you end up with antibiotic resistance. Now here's the good news. There is a natural, non-toxic, inexpensive ways of helping yourself. First and foremost, and I realize people don't discuss this in media. They feel it's kind of off limits, and I feel nothing's off limits if it helps people. an awful lot of women and men end up with urinary tract infections, but principally women in this case, because of lack of sanitation. What do I mean? If you examine the distance between a woman's rectum and her urethra, and a very short urethra, it's very small, versus a man's urethra. Now, when a woman is having intercourse, and a man's testicles hit against her rectum, and then the moisture that's created, both out of the rectum and the vagina, act as a lubricant to allow the fecal bacteria on the anus to move into the vagina and the urethra at the top of the vagina, that's how most of this infection occurs. Hard to imagine that in a society that prides itself on the advancement in its technology that we should still be living almost a dark ages in hygiene. I see it every day. Yesterday when I was getting my juice, I saw someone come in, and I happen to know this person. She is a professor at Columbia University, and she reached over and she took a cherry and tried a cherry. No problem trying a cherry, organic cherry. And I mentioned to her, I said, I would suggest that you wash that. Why? It's organic. I said, yes, and that means that it was grown organically, but it was also harvested by people who don't have proper sanitation. As many as 10 to 15 different hands have touched that cherry in sorting, packing, resorting, bagging. And how do you know that there's fecal contamination or some other virus or bacteria or parasite that's now on the surface of that? And then she kind of looked at the cherry and said, I didn't think about that. I said, the trouble is every day in America, people are putting things in their mouths without thinking about, is it clean? If so, by what standard? I never eat anything raw in restaurants, simply because I know, having owned 4 restaurants, that even with the best of efforts, a lot of times things don't get cleaned as they should, especially when you're in a restaurant and things are rushed and you get an order in and you're out of salad in your salad storage area, so your sous chef opens up a box, throws stuff in the sink, quickly sprays it, and that would be like you working out all day in a coal mine and then walking through a shower in 3 seconds and saying you're clean. Not at all. So we should have a bidet in every person's home in America who could afford one. And if you can afford a flat-screen TV, you can afford a bidet. It's a simple, it looks like a toilet bowl, but it has a spigot in it, and it shoots water up at different temperatures. You can control the temperatures and the force of the spray, and it can, with soap, simple soap, after you have vacated, you then wash yourself thoroughly, rinse yourself, and now you're clean. Wiping with toilet paper cleans nothing. It is absolutely barbaric. And yet we think that that's hygiene. It is not. So that's the number one way I believe that most Americans end up getting urinary tract infections. There are other ways also, but that's something we can actually handle. So the rule is wash, don't just wipe. All right, washing, then at least you're not going to cause that because you're not going to have the bacteria there. And ask your partner to wash also. Gee whiz, why? Well, because where do you think a man's testicles are? They're right down there, sweating, and near the anus, which means that the same bacteria coming out of a woman can come out of a man and contaminate the testicles. So if you're clean and your partner is not, you're risking having contamination. So just, my goodness. I mean, in this day and age, with all that we've achieved, we have to learn about cleaning ourselves. Yeah, we do. We don't wash our hands. We don't wash under our fingernails. We don't use water in our mouths to clean between teeth. Most people don't use dental floss. People don't clean their ears. It's amazing the lack of hygiene in our society. But we're good at putting perfumes on things and disguising it. So what do? Now we have an infection. Well, there's several things. First, the most powerful thing I could suggest that is natural, non-toxic, would come from a flower. The Sabdariffa flower, it is known as hibiscus. Hi, H-I-B-I-S, C-U-S, hibiscus. It has really good antibacterial action against microorganisms that cause urinary tract infections. It also can suppress the fungus responsible for common yeast infections. Now, the natural compounds that we're going to find, according to Victoria Dobie, in hibiscus complement the efficacy of cranberries. Now, everybody's heard of cranberries, and that's good. But the cranberry juice, you don't know how much you're getting. It's mainly water, and you don't know. To make a profit, they put a little bit of cranberries in there, a little bit of concentrate, and some sugar. So my suggestion is you get a pure, undiluted, unsweetened cranberry concentrate. Now, that means that about 70% of the original water, after its juice has been vacuumed off. So it hasn't just been diluted, it's been concentrated. It is the concentrated, I repeat, the concentrated cranberry nutrients that can kill the infections. Now, women suffering from the urinary tract infections and generally having about 8 different infections per year, I'm going to suggest 400 milligrams of hibiscus per day, and that will reduce your urinary tract infection reoccurrence to almost nothing. So that's the very first step. And also, how do you know that you have urinary tract infection? Well, understand that once that bacteria is in there, and generally it's the E. coli from your GI tract and the anus to the urethra, that causes 95% of the acute non-complicated urinary tract infection. Then Staphylococcus saprophyticus accounts for most of the remainder. And once that bacteria squirms this way, just like sperm, it travels, it moves, it migrates. And then it's going to take hold inside your bladder, and then it's going to descend into your kidneys. You leave this unchecked, you can lead to conditions of kidney infections. And acute kidney infections, you end up with shaking chills and high fever and pain in the muscles and joints. And it can be very dangerous. You don't want this. And in fact, in severe cases, it can progress to sepsis, which is a potentially fatal whole body infection of the tissue and bloodstream. So several things you can do. First, ozone treatment. That's good. You want to stop the initial bacterial infection. That's proper hygiene. That's good. And then you have to look at the concentration of proanthocyanidins, or what are called PACs, proanthocyanidins, D-I-N-S. And then the most recent studies do not indicate a change in urine pH brought about by cranberries, meaning they do not acidify urine. Instead, cranberries' antimicrobial action arises from a class of the flavonoids, which are the proanthocyanidins. So I would take separately 200 milligrams of them. And that way that can help. And then vitamin C, wild oregano oil, all this can make a difference. All right, so for everyone who wants to prevent chronic infection or reinfection, and by the way, the very same protocol that helps you also helps you decrease Candida albicans. So that's all good information. Now, the onion, in my opinion, is one of nature's most perfect foods. I believe that an onion a day keeps a stroke away. We know that it will, based upon hundreds of studies, that it has quercetin. That helps your skin, keeps your skin tighter, because it helps create new collagen. And collagen is the matrix that drapes the outer layer of the skin. And when the collagen is tight, your skin is tight. And it rejuvenates itself. So if you want younger, healthier skin, then you want to take onions. It also is very good in the sulfur compounds, and that helps kill bacteria and viruses throughout your system. It also thins the blood naturally. Does the same thing aspirin does, but I believe a lot better, because there's no chance of having bleeding in the intestine. To the contrary, it can kill the Helicobacter E. pylori, and that helps you. in the stomach. Here's the latest on why an onion a day and how you take your onion a day. Start with a half an onion. Start with a quarter onion. Cut a sweet organic onion up. Run it under cold water for about 60 seconds. That gets rid of the volatile oils, but keeps everything as nutrition so it won't burn. Then try it in a salad. Or try it on a really nice way of eating onion is raw, is to have it mixed into your brown rice or quinoa after you've prepared it. It gives a nice warm from the cooking of the brown rice or quinoa, cold and crunchy from the onion. It's a really nice balance. I put it in baked potatoes, raw, and then work yourself up till you can have a little more and a little more. So by the end of the day, if you had a whole onion in you, you're helping thin your blood, you're helping prevent blood clots, you're helping kill bacteria and viruses. It's just good all the way down the line. So an onion a day keeps a stroke away. This is from the Aju University School of Medicine, South Korea, and it was published in the peer-reviewed journal Nutrition. Quote, onions' antioxidants potential may offer brain benefits. Supplementing the diet with onion and extracts from the vegetable may protect the brain from additional damage linked to stroke. And this was good. So one more reason it can help the brain, especially if you're susceptible to stroke or if you've had a previous stroke. And if you've had a previous stroke, I would suggest getting about 100 hyperbaric oxygen therapies, which can help repair damage that your doctor or neurologist didn't know could be repaired. It can be. I'm opposed, 100% opposed, to all synthetic hormone replacement therapy. There is no basis. You cannot show me an instance, whether it's thinning of the bones, leading to osteoporosis, or turning off a hot flash, which are the only two reasons women use synthetic hormone replacement therapy generally. I can show you natural, non-toxic ways to do that, and we've proven it. It's not speculation. It's not subjective. Over a 12-month period with 247 women who had menopause or postmenopause, who suffered an average of 14 separate situations, either hot flashes, night sweats, a gain in weight, mood swings, loss of hair on the eyebrows and the head, a thinning of the skin, all these different conditions, and thinning of the mucous membrane in the vagina, making it painful or impossible for normal relations with her partner. We reversed all those. We reversed them, and almost the people that stayed on the program, almost 94%. That study, its results, the testimonials are all up on my website. You can see this for yourself. I submitted this. It was accepted for publication, and I was invited as a keynote speaker to a large group of scientists, about 5,000 scientists, in Chicago 4 years ago, and I presented it. So this is as good as it gets. Clinical studies, lots of human beings, changes made and changes sustained, and follow-up concurring. It works. All with lifestyle, none with drugs. Here's the latest on why I'm opposed, why you should be too, and why you should be looking for natural therapies. This comes from University of Western Sydney. 43,405 postmenopausal women were in the study. Quote, hormone replacement therapy associated with an increased blood pressure in women. And this was published in the journal PLOS One, which is one of the most respected scientific journals in the world. Quote, longer hormone use was associated with even further increased odds of high blood pressure. So we know that high blood pressure can lead to stroke, kidney damage, and you don't want that. So my suggestion, get off the hormones, synthetic hormone replacement therapy, and start making modifications in diet and lifestyles. The entire protocols are on the website free and there to help you. I'm Gary Nall, here to talk about the issues that make a difference. We're finished with our health and nutrition segment. I'm going to go to our commentary segment, then to our guest. And then we'll take some calls. About 4 days ago, I began a multi-part series of an original in-depth investigative report called Bad to the Bone, Fraud is the Business Plan, In it, I examine two mega corporations, GlaxoSmithKline, the maker of the measles, mumps, rubella vaccine, and other vaccines and drugs, including Paxil, and a whole history of fraud, and how many people have died using their drugs. Today I'll continue. But in my with Merck, and they've gotten some really bad products they've made, including Vioxx, which killed 60,000 people. Yesterday, near the end of the show, I talked about how two whistleblowing scientists were engaged in trying to prove that the MMR vaccine would be 95% efficacious. But when they did this, they found that it wasn't. And then a senior investigator, David Krall, admitted to a doctor crawling that the efficacy of the mumps vaccine had declined over time because every time they make the vaccine, they have to pass it through and pass it through and pass it through, and it degrades the efficacy of the vaccine. So then they found, gee whiz, well, this isn't efficacious, so we're not going to associate with telling the world this is efficacious because people are going to get this vaccine thing. It's going to protect them, and it won't. Now, Crawling and the other whistleblower, Wolchowski, questioned the falsification and manipulation of the data with their superiors. Now, here's where it gets interesting. They called the FDA numerous times to report the fraud, despite the fact that Dr. Crawling was threatened with jail if he contacted the FDA. He continued, the FDA finally sent an agent, but did not discover the fraudulent testing in the course of just a very superficial perfunctory visit. Shortly thereafter, Dr. Crawling was removed from his what was called the 007 project and resigned from Merck, and Wolchowski was removed about a month later, left the company. The end result is the only mumps vaccine available in the United States is one that has been proven to be minimally effective because of an erroneous study, an enormous fraud perpetrated by Merck. When the investigators at Merck first discovered that the mumps vaccine was not up to par back in 1999, David Krall admitted to Crawling that it would lead to outbreaks of mumps, which would increase over time and would peak at three-year intervals, as the natural virus always did prior to vaccination, which is exactly what happened. In 2006, the United States experienced a multi-state outbreak involving 6,554 reported cases of mumps. This resurgence was predominantly in highly vaccinated Midwestern college students, with the highest attack rates occurring among those living in dormitories. But mind you, these are students who had had all of their mumps vaccines, the MMR vaccines. And then, beginning in July 2009, another mumps outbreak affected more than 5,000 people in the Northeast who also had a high vaccine compliance rate. The CDC was unable to blame these outbreaks on parents who refused to vaccinate their children because those children did not get the virus. But they still found a way to spin it to their advantage on the conclusion. Mind you, the kids who got the mumps had the vaccine against the mumps. Quote, this is from the government. Public health experts believe that the high two-dose vaccine coverage greatly limited the size of the outbreak. Without that coverage, there might have been even tens or even hundreds of thousands of cases. So once again, they're taking credit for something that there is absolutely zero proof of. It's a sign of the audacity of modern propaganda techniques that the CDC can pronounce vaccine failure results in two large mumps outbreaks, vaccination success. Obviously, the mumps vaccine actually, in their mind, should be used, and yet it did not work. And all because the initial fraud was never exposed. And since Merck's own list of adverse effects include atypical measles, it is important to note that the whistleblowers in the lawsuit worked strictly with the mumps vaccine and the combined MMR and not measles or rubella. The fact that they did not bring charges against Merck for the measles or rubella vaccine does not mean that we can rest assured that these two vaccines meet their efficacy testing goals. All we know is that no one close to the situation has been willing to come forward and say there's a problem. But with Merck's track record, one has to be suspicious. In conclusion, while denying all the charges as factually false, Merck has also made a point of stressing that none of the allegations relate to the safety of his product. Of course, Merck knows full well that the whistleblowers were not in a position to comment firsthand on safety since their work only involved lab specimens. Meanwhile, just in May of 2012, an Italian court awarded a family compensation based on finding that the MMR vaccine, reportedly Merck's own MMR2, was the cause of their son's autism. And on July 6th of this year, news was released that in a lawsuit to release records from the 2010 Omnibus Autism Proceedings, Hooker versus United States Department of Health and Human Services, the judge has ordered the U.S. to deliver documents previously withheld from the public by this week. So more damaging news is going to come. The MMR whistleblower lawsuit is hardly the first time that Merck has been caught misrepresenting one of their products. Who can forget their largest fiasco so far with Vioxx? The blockbuster non-steroidal anti-inflammatory caused 60,000 deaths, 100,000 heart attacks and strokes because Merck and the FDA conveniently overlooked the evidence of risk that was right there in their own clinical trials. Vioxx earned the company $2.5 billion a year by the time it was yanked from the market, which shows the power of marketing. They kept for 4 years, 5 years, they kept the news from getting out that this drug could have fatal side effects. And while Merck has always maintained that it withdrew Vioxx as soon as results from a certain clinical trial showed the cardiovascular risk, a new report from just this week provides evidence that Merck had undeniable proof that Vioxx caused a significant increase in cardiovascular deaths more than 3 years before it was removed from the market. This report shows how Merck, quote, intention to treat analysis of placebo-controlled studies was withheld from publication and instead only, quote, on-treatment analysis was reported, which made it possible to hide the increased death rate. Last year, in November, Merck agreed to plead guilty to one count of violating the Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act for introducing a misbranded drug, Vioxx, into the interstate commerce by promoting the drug for treatment of rheumatoid arthritis before the use was approved by the Food and Drug Administration. This comes in addition to the $4.85 billion Merck agreed to pay to settle 27,000 Vioxx lawsuits in 2007. Under the terms of its plea agreement with the United States, Merck will plead guilty to a misdemeanor for its illegal promotion activity, will pay 321 man $636,000 in criminal fines. Merck also agreed to a civil settlement agreement under which it will pay $628,364,000 to cover a broader range of illegal activity. But remember, in 2005, most analysts predicted that Merck's ultimate Vioxx liability would be $25 billion. So Merck pays $5 billion and walks away $20 billion richer, and the only thing it had to contend with, well, but it didn't, was that 60,000 Americans died, 100,000 were injured, and it only had to acknowledge a misdemeanor. That's our report for today. I will continue on tomorrow. The full report, bad to the bone, fraud is the business plan, is on my website. Please download it. I'm Gary Knoll. In a moment, my guest. Please stay with us.
Never be.
like to welcome all of you who are just joining us around the world. I'm Gary Knoll, broadcasting live and video streaming live from our studios in New York. A big upgrade on our studios coming in the next 2 weeks. We're going to have four cameras in here. We do it all. We have a larger studio, which we're going to be premiering in September. First, let me say hello to my special guest today, Professor Joel Bakan, B-A-K-A-N.
Yeah.
We're going to talk about a look at corporate pathology and its role in the domination of children's development for profit and power. But something interesting came up this past Saturday. The New York Times headline, front page, showed that the FDA had been found to have illegally hacked or stolen 80,000 documents off its scientists, activists, went to members of Congress on their website, to lawyers, including the lawyers, personal lawyers, and even the chief advocate for the FDA that the whistleblowers were speaking with. All of that is supposed to be protected information. These were their private emails, not their government work. And the private intelligence agency contractor who was doing this for the FDA claims that they got permission from the top lawyers in the FDA. But here's the piece of the puzzle that are interesting. I have a letter from these whistleblowers when Barack Obama and his transition team were entering the White House. And in that letter, which I read yesterday on the air, two separate letters, they claim that all of the managers of the FDA overseeing new drugs and medical devices were engaged in fraud, that these products were not safe, and they felt that it was not right to allow a new product to come to the market where its efficacy was not what we were being told. Now, a historical look shows that over 50% of all FDA-approved drugs in one 10-year period were withdrawn or relabeled. We know that what I just read, Vioxx killed 60,000. But one of those people I interviewed and one of those whistleblowers was Dr. David Graham. So Graham knew prior to it being marketed that it was dangerous, would not have approved it, but the FDA had its insider group. Now, then here's how the FDA handles. Well, we had an independent group. And then you look at their backgrounds, 60% of all the members on the committees all have vested interest. They're all compromised. So then you say, you're passing the buck on this. And so now the question is, I want to know, this is Watergate. This is big. This is massive. Because in all these years I've been in the field, and all the documentaries I've done, we've never been able to get the real smoking gun until Alec was uncovered. And then we saw how all these state legislators had over 780 pieces of legislation at the state level that we thought our state representatives were enacting, which was nothing more than Coca-Cola and Walmart meeting with the state legislators, writing the legislation. We knew that the Medicare bill was a fraud because it didn't allow the government to even negotiate lower prices for drugs. That was a trillion-dollar kiss to the pharmaceutical industry. But this is hard, hard data. It shows that they had an enemies list, and they had defined it as an enemies list. Interesting, the 21 people they have as their enemies are all in my new film. I've been filming this film for 3.5 years. Now, interesting, so here's what I will ask people to consider, but I cannot make a 100% conclusion yet. These people, these noble, honest scientists, wrote a letter to Barack Obama and his team. And Obama's team was all corporate insiders, whether they were Vilsack from USDA and Lawrence Summers. They were all top players in the corporate game. Now, instead of doing a single thing to protect the American public about these allegations, Obama or someone in his group went back to the FDA and said, "You got a problem here." Then they start illegally tapping and collecting all the data and even talking about how they did it, how they could take a system that would go inside the back of computers and pull up and looking for any compromising material, porn, anything at all, salacious material. This is the level of the FDA. Now, mind you, this is the FDA that I did a documentary last year, Death by Medicine, the year before, Prescription for Disaster. I've been hammering these guys for decades, but nothing ever happens to them. They're like Ronald Reagan. You know, he might as well be at Mount Teflon. Rushmore, right? Teflon. But now it clearly shows that high up in the White House, right through every, mind you, when you have anything discussed like this in the White House at a cabinet level, everyone's in on those conversations. And that means the President of the United States in on. So everyone knew clear back, and then they did this illegal activity. This is big, because now we find out late last night, we find out from Steve Kahn, who is the top whistleblower lawyer down there, that hedge funds were behind it also. What the hell does a hedge fund have to do with illegal hacking by the FDA? Oh, how about some of those so-called miracle drugs that they had put big places bets on? Mm-hmm. And now if their bets are shown by some honest FDA scientist to say, no, this is a bad drug, they lose that money. So now we're going to get the hedge fund, we're going to get the equity partnerships, we're going to get the corporate people, we're going to get the pharmaceutical company. They're all going to be exposed on this, because we cannot allow this to go unchallenged. I just want to share that with you, because I know you have a really keen interest in how corporations manipulate policymakers, opinion leaders, create laws to protect themselves. Would you address this, please?
No, absolutely. And one of the major areas I investigate in my recent book, Childhood Under Siege, is the pharmaceutical industry, and in particular, the role of the pharmaceutical industry in perpetuating new disorders, creating new disorders, supporting research for new disorders in order to drug children. And one of the really sorry stories in all of that was that's just kind of fodder for what you're talking about. And I'm sure you're aware of this, was the burying of data on drugs made by Pfizer and Eli Lilly in particular, the burying of data that these psychotropic drugs actually promoted suicidal behavior when used by children. The FDA knew this. The companies knew this. The data was buried until it came out sort of by accident in some unrelated lawsuits, and people made a big stink about it. But I think what underlies both your story and that story is the complete absence of what we would consider to be ethics in the conduct both of government officials and of corporate officials around these issues. And I guess one way that I like to talk about this in very broad terms is that we seem to have gone from a society that has corporations as part of it to a society that is, in its essential dimensions, corporate, including in terms of how interests are laid out, how incentives are produced, what our ethics are, what our norms are. And then this kind of behavior starts to make some twisted sense. Hedge funds investing in new drugs, the new drugs, and then people, pillaging and pirating, problematic, stuff that might cause those new drugs to not have the marketing lives that they have. So it all starts to make some twisted sense when we think about our society as having lost its way, in terms of its values and in terms of its ethics. It sort of embraced this this corporate way of approaching things in all of our institutions.
Could we go a little further on this, please? Because this is something I know you've done a great deal of work on. I want to tie two issues in simultaneously, if you feel that there is a bridge. On the one, the American people are not educated about the nature of disease, its pathogenesis, what causes disease. They have some vague oversight, but we're certainly not practicing it, because we have no national program to show us real models of health that would be outside of a pharmaceutical or a major corporate food interest. So if we said, if you have more fresh juices, fresh fruits and vegetables, if you eat organic, if you exercise, if you de-stress, you're going to live a longer, healthier life, and most of this would prevent diseases. Instead, to do that, they would have to run up against McDonald's and hamburgers and Coca-Cola and Bud Light and all these other things and pharmaceutical drugs to treat these conditions. So instead of telling us about health and prevention, which should be an ethical consideration, instead they tell us about what we should do on a daily basis when we feel frustrated or we can't sleep or we feel socially isolated to take a particular drug or food or product, none of which reverses any of the underlying cause. And I'm asking, forget the lack of science. There is zero science on their side to showing by drinking a Budweiser somehow I'm a better observing athlete, or by taking their sleeping medication I'm going to be able to correct any sleeping disorder. There's no proof to the contrary. Where's the ethics, knowing that there's going to be children becoming diabetic with adult diabetes and morbid obesity? There's going to be labeling of people with illnesses that do not exist in reality and treated with drugs that do not help. And all the while, everyone knows it who's in the system. You can't find me a scientist or a physician or an administrator at the FDA, USDA, the National Institutes of Health, National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Disease, National Institute of Aging, National Institute of Mental Health, who is not fully aware of everything I just said. Yet not a single person, not one single person will stand up and say everything we're doing to the American public is simply exploiting them in their innocence and their trust in us. Where is the ethics in any of this? Your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, that is the link among a number of different issues that I look at in both of my books. In the last book, I'm interested in how marketing is fueling the consumption of junk food. I'm interested in how we as a society are doing nothing about the about industrial toxins going into children's environments, BPA, all kinds of horrible toxins, and I'm interested in how we are looking to pills to address every sort of minor quake or vicissitude in children's living. And what links all of those together is that we have somehow bought into this notion that the market should just operate as it does, that corporations should be allowed to do whatever they have to do in order to make a buck, even if that means inventing diseases, even if so that children will take pills, even if that means repressing information that shows links between environmental and industrial toxins and autism or birth defects or any of those things, even if that means repressing the obvious connection between marketing, junk food consumption, obesity, and diabetes. I mean, there's an incredible machine at work that is either repressing fears, and I talk about the need in my book, I talk about the need to fear accurately. And there's a big machine in place that is making us unable to fear accurately. It is repressing fears that we should have, and it's exaggerating fears that we don't need to have.
Then would you say, or do you feel it's legitimate if I say that we have a corporate pathology at work here?
Well, absolutely. I mean, the central idea in both of my recent books is that corporations are pathological. That, you know, we say that corporations are persons. What I try to do is ask the next question, what kind of persons are they? And when I look at it as an attorney, I look at corporate law, and what it says is that the directors and managers and everybody down from them in a corporation have a fiduciary duty to shareholders to always put the interests of wealth creation above any other interests, above the interests of health, above the interests of the environment, above the interests of worker safety. The only interest that matters to a corporation is self-interest. And when you take that character and you put it into an actual breathing human being, you would probably diagnose that person as a sociopath or a psychopath. So what we've done is we've created this corporate person in the image of a psychopathic or sociopathic individual. And the difference between it and a psychopathic individual is that corporations tend to be the amassed power of many individuals. So not only do they have this amoral constitution as institutions, but they have immense power and growing power in the world. And increasingly, they are, and their ethos are defining the ethos of our key institutions in civil society, whether it's education or science. All institutions are now starting to be constituted through the normative framework that the corporation is, which is the book I'm currently writing is We're All Psychopaths Now, because that idea is now becoming the idea that drives society as a whole.
This is all in the book, Childhood Under Siege, How Big Business Targets Children. Let's take one step back then. When I was producing the film The Drugging of Our Children about 5 years ago, I wondered what had happened to parenting from our generation to the current generation, because we didn't have any children diagnosed with ADD and ADHD. Suicide in young boys was non-existent. Today it's the number one cause of death in 10 to 14-year-olds. We didn't have anyone walking in and killing, you know, as many people as they could at Columbine. And when I went out to Columbine and we filmed there, we found out that Eric Harris, one of the shooters, had been on Effexor. Yet that seemed to have been missed by all the media. Mm-hmm. And they thought it was all about the guns. And I said, change a person's perception of reality, and if they don't have a gun, they'll use a baseball bat. Mm-hmm. So let's take a look at the writings for a moment of Henry Giroux. I know you know who he is, from Ontario. And he's talking about the dumbing down of critical thinking in our schools and colleges and the return of the two educational system, one for the children of the elite and the privileged, and another for everyone else who are being mentally doped up to be worker bees, in effect, the indoctrinating process. Can you relate this to the pathological nature of large corporations which support privatization of education? And if you had to try to divine what their ultimate goal is, what would it be? Because clearly there is an agenda here that we're not being told about.
In my book, I quote from an interview that I did with a fellow named Benno Schmidt, Jr. He's the former president of Yale University, and then he ran the Edison, an education management organization, for a while. And basically what he said was, when you look at the American economy, there is only one area that is larger than education, and that's healthcare. And basically, the corporate sector has had its eye on education for some time. There's a huge amount of money to be made, whether it's through producing standardized tests or marking those standardized tests or actually running schools as education management organizations do on a for-profit basis. When you look at Obama's recent education reforms and you look at various reforms across the different states, you see a very similar theme, and it's the theme that has been propagated by leading philanthropists such as Bill and Melinda Gates and many others. And the theme is that what we need to do with the school system is tie it directly to the needs, the interests, and the operation of corporate America. That what schools should become are places that create workers, A, and B, they should be profit centers for corporations.
Where's critical thinking?
Critical thinking was an idea, and I say was with some regret, was an idea that was part of the original origins of our American public school system. What people thought, and I'm thinking of John Dewey, the philosopher, and others who were very big on bringing in public education, they saw public education as having two primary functions. One was to create people with the skills to be productive members of society, including in the workplace. Two was to create people with the skills to be citizens. The fundamental idea was that democracy could not exist if you didn't have an informed, critical thinking population that was capable of acquitting themselves of the responsibilities of democratic citizenship. What we're seeing today is a severing of that second function from the education system. Where in all the talk about education, you don't hear about that anymore. You don't hear about the need for critical thinking. You hear that we need to create workers for a globalized economy. You don't hear we need to create people who are capable of thinking about that globalized economy critically and thinking about what we should do with it or whether we should pursue this or that course. You don't hear that anymore. It's become very utilitarian. And it's also become two-tier. Because what you see in the United States is that in the inner cities, you see the development of corporations coming in and running schools, often known as career academies, where they've entirely, including in New York City, there are quite a few of these, where they've given up on the notion of providing a liberal education and basically said, we're going to train kids here for the tourism industry, or we're going to train them for low-wage jobs in hospitals or in the restaurant industry. We're not going to sort of have this notion that we should be giving everybody the same kind of liberal education. So in these schools, there is not even the pretense of the notion that public schooling should be serving the needs of individuals and of democracy by creating informed, critical thinking citizens. This, I believe, is what's happening in education. I spend two chapters on it in my book. What's happening in education, I think, is one of the most dangerous developments in society today.
Joel, I'd like to share two offshoot thoughts with you on what you just said. On the one hand, without good education, including the liberal arts, including understanding the concepts of dialoguing on philosophy, on social context, on political systems, on the meaning of life, then how can we use any judgment when both corporate Democrats and corporate Republicans, that's all we have had since Ronald Reagan? How can we possibly then go beyond the argument that they're going to find jobs for 8.2% of the unemployed, which is not true in itself? We can't even be honest about our statistics, because anytime you stop looking for a job, you're no longer counted as unemployed. When today in the United States, the International Ladies Garment Workers Union, you'll make about $29 an hour, more or less, if you make a shirt. In Bangladesh, it's 14 cents an hour. In China, it's anywhere from 35 to 55 cents an hour. And now with a new South Korean workers plant opening up in Haiti, it could be 9 cents an hour. How in the world will any of these jobs that we once had in the United States and 58,000 factories that have been closed in the last 12 years, how will any of these jobs ever come back unless they come back in a form of indentured servitude? Because we're not going to be able to compete by making a shirt that anyone's going to buy when the shirt cost $35 to make in the United States and $1.50 in Bangladesh and $1.80 in China. And if the bottom line is profit, and if we're conditioned to believe in going to Walmart, and if we're conditioned by our educational system to believe our leaders, then where is the average person going to get out of this trap, since everything they're doing is in a circular motion of following the guidance of their conditioning?
Two things say, at least two things. One is that we already have indentured labor to a large extent in our agricultural sector in this country, which isn't that much different than what goes on in making shirts in Bangladesh in some sectors. And the second thing to add to your excellent point is that what's going on with making shirts is now going on as well with engineering, with law, where you have large firms basically relying in particular on Indian engineers, engineers in India. You have researchers in India doing law briefs for major firms in the United States. You know, even something as simple as you've done some dictation and you want to get it transcribed into written form, there are places in India you can send it to for a lot less. So, so it's not, it's highly skilled labor, that is going offshore as well.
8.4 million jobs under that visa plan that no one discussed. The American media refused to touch it, but I played on this program a month ago. A lawyers group meeting in a big hotel with all these corporate heads showing how we can bring in a labor. Let's say you've got an employee that's been there 16 years. They're making $175,000 and they've got an MIT master's degree in engineering. We can get that same person for $60,000, no union, no hassle, no seniority. And suddenly all these jobs are legally coming in the United States. More people are legally coming in and taking the place of highly trained, qualified seniority positions than are illegal aliens coming across the border.
Right. And of course, it's not a case of not wanting people from other countries to have opportunities. Of course, we do.
Yeah.
The central issue is parity, as you mentioned. And you can go two ways to achieve parity. You can go from the top to the bottom, or you can go from the bottom to the top. And I don't think there is a simple answer to your question. Capitalism, and particularly corporate capitalism, has no place for sentiment. For saying, oh, we should be concerned about American workers. And if anybody is mouthing that in a corporation, they're being hypocritical, because basically their bottom line is what's important. My hope when I look ahead is that the parity will come from some kind of movement in both directions. I mean,
ethical capitalism,
but I don't think ethical capitalism can happen without a large democratic intervention to help make it happen. Markets will not bring ethical capitalism on their own.
I have time for, by the way, we're going to be saying goodbye to some of our stations in a moment, but you can continue listening to our conversation by calling a telephone number, a nice technology now, 832-280-0066, 832-280-0066. A million minutes listened, 50,000 people listening over the telephone, or you can listen over the internet. Very important to me is how major corporations are pathologizing childhood, making up completely fictitious diagnosis like authority defiance disorder, social anxiety disorder, and then selling drugs, all with the complete and tacit approval of the FDA, the American Academy of Pediatrics. None of the major journals, including Science, Nature, Journal of the American Medical Association, have challenged this. And you have 900,000 physicians in the United States, a large subset of psychiatrists who are supporting this. And I'm offended that we are now looking to give children as young as 6 months of age an antipsychotic medication because they've been diagnosed with bipolar condition, a complete fraudulent diagnosis. Yeah. And yet the media, the New York Times, no one has challenged them on this. Your thoughts, please. And I know you do in Childhood Under Siege, how big pharma's business is targeting our children.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I spent a couple of chapters on it, and there are so many entrance points that big pharma use. They hire drug reps to go around and pressure and seduce doctors to prescribe drugs, often off label, to children. They become involved they're becoming much more involved in research and funding research and designing research. So clinical trials themselves are not as independent as they once were. They hire people like Joseph Biederman, for example, the father of pediatric bipolar disorder, who recently got into a bit of trouble. But they hire people like that to give talks at continuing education for doctors. I mean, they just, every point of entrance that's possible, from research through publication, dissemination, medical education, they are there. And they're there with one purpose, and that's to sell their products. And selling their products, and including the new DSM-5,
it's a comic book.
Which is a huge story, because what they're doing in that is they are now moving from disorders to pre-disorders, sub-disorders, and so that they're broadening the range of activity that then gets tainted because, well, maybe it's related to this order, a precursor, you better take the drug. And so there's no question that the targeting of children's mental disorders and mental problems is big business and is being driven by concerns to make money, not concerns about children. I try to document that in my book.
Well, just take one example. A young teenager in the Midwest wrote two answers to a teen screen survey.
Yeah.
She was taken from her home. Her parents could not intercede. Her parents were threatened, all right, by a state agency, Child Services. She was put in a mental institution for 6 months. She was given multiple therapies there. Why? Because she answered that she didn't like having a messy room. Ah, obsessive compulsive disorder. And she didn't like going to noisy parties. Ah, and the social anxiety disorder. That's how they're playing it. Now, they've got the law on their sides in many states, not the parents' insights. So I don't see that we have an epidemic of mental illness in this country. I see we have normal behavior where they're now making reactions like depression, anxiety, and fear, anger. In normal life situations, they're pathologizing it so they can profit from it, and we should have had the FDA step forward. Now I understand why the FDA has been so reluctant to say, hold on a second, what do you mean you got a drug that will help someone with a pre-manic disorder at the age of 2? There's nonsense. Yeah. But the pharmaceutical industry plays the entire system, and who are the pharmaceutical industry? These are people.
Right.
They're people, but they're people who work within a particular environment of incentives and of disciplines. And that's one of the points I try to make in my book, The Corporation, and in the last one, is that it's inaccurate to say the problem we're facing is because these are all bad people. The problem is that we have an institution that shapes human behavior in ways that cause people to do things that serve one purpose and undermine other purposes. And that it's a difficult problem between individual moral agency and what you do when you're a part of an institution. It's an age-old problem in philosophy. But this is what I see happening in corporations. They're not fundamentally bad people who work in and run corporations. They're people who are serving the ethical mission of the institution they're a part of. And they either have to quit or they have to operate by that incentive system.
They're rewarded for operating and they're highly protective. It's a very paternalistic society. People fight hard to get into there. Yeah. And then, like last week, there was a group of them every year that meet out to in Utah at this investment broker's ranch. And there's Barry Diller and Bill Gates and Warren Buffett and all the top corporate heads, right? Maybe 100, 200 people meet casually. They're there to share their ideas about the future of the world. Who elected them to do that? When have they been right when it comes to serving all the public's needs? And yet the media will cover about how important it is that this happens. Well, I appreciate the effort that you have made and the scholarship you have brought to your new work. The new work is one that I highly recommend. It is called Childhood Under Siege, How Big Business Targets Children. Professor Joel Bakken. Joel is a lawyer, professor of constitutional and economic law, and an internationally recognized legal scholar at the University of British Columbia. He is a Rhodes Scholar and has law degrees from Oxford and Harvard universities. And also, Joel was the author of the best-selling book that turned into a documentary which won the Academy Award, The Corporation, The Pathological Pursuit of Profit, which won 23 international awards. And he is there for us. I appreciate you being there for us.
Appreciate your being there for us. Thank you.
I'm Gary Noll. Thank you all for watching. We look forward to sharing more. I'm going to run upstairs now because I've got to raise some funds for WBAI, our sister station. We'll be back in with our next program here in a moment. Please stay with us. Oh.